And it's time for a postcard. Producer Hagar Cohen has jumped onto this side of the glass and she's ready to present. Hagar, where are we off to?
We're going tonight to Nepal, which is arguably, although I don't think you're going to argue with me, that it's probably one of the most beautiful countries in the world.
Oh, look, I am lucky enough years ago to have gotten up to Nepal. And, you know, bought the jumper. And you've been there yourself, though, haven't you?
I have, yes, I have been. I actually went to the Annapurna region in the Himalaya, did the whole three-week track. It was absolutely beautiful, which is why I'm very, very jealous of our next guest, who is Louise Khoury. Now, she's one of those lucky Australians who scored a job helping the local community in Nepal develop its health, education and economic systems, but she's been there for quite a while, lucky girl, and she's working on behalf of World Vision Australia, and she's got quite a lot of experience with HIV awareness campaigns. And she begins by telling us about World Vision's program in southern Nepal.
Well, one that we're supporting down in the southern part of the country is working to raise awareness amongst high school students and youth, i.e. Kids between the age of about 12 up to 16 who are at high school, and also those between 17 and 24, just to raise awareness about what HIV/AIDS is, how it can negatively impact their communities, and so that they understand how HIV is transmitted, but also how it's prevented, because there are a lot of misconceptions amongst young people. They assume that it's only people who engage in illicit sexual activities or are taking drugs who are vulnerable to HIV. But there are also a lot of misconceptions that HIV can be transmitted through food or from sleeping in the same bed with someone in non-sexual contact, or even just sitting in a community meeting with someone who happens to have HIV.
So it's more of a preventative program?
This one's more a preventative program. When you're working with HIV, HIV awareness raising and prevention is one dimension, and then providing direct care and support for people who are affected by HIV is another dimension as well. In this particular project, it's more awareness raising, because it's quite a new initiative for us to be working directly with young people around the issue of HIV. But a logical follow-on for this project is to be working more with young people who are actually affected with HIV and to be able to work with other local agencies and health institutions to provide support for them.
In what type of communities are you working from?
I support our programs out in the west, and we have five out in the west, and they range between communities located down on the southern part of Nepal, and many of these communities have similar cultural and ethnic backgrounds to those living in northern India. So they're mainly Hindu. A lot of them have lived in this area for a long time, but if you saw them, they would actually look like those from northern India. And then in the other extreme, we are implementing one program up in the northern part of the country, which is in a high mountain region. And these people look more Mongolian, and their culture and, you know, ethnicity is really quite different. So we need to take that into consideration when we're implementing our programs.
So how do you mean? How does their ethnicity or culture affect ways in which they are able to productively use that information that you're giving them?
Well, I don't think there's actually any major differences. When it comes to an issue such as HIV, for example, ethnicity is not... it's not necessarily going to require a change of project approach, but I think what it does do is that different ethnic groups, you know, have different perceptions and understanding of HIV depending on where they're working, how they're working, whether their children are going to school, whether the parents are migrating, and that you see different patterns according to, you know, the different ethnic groups.
So what's the interesting developments that we see in Western Nepal, for example?
The main thing is that it's an area of Nepal which is very, very poor, and that there's a number of adults leaving districts for work in other places, some of them to India and some of them to other countries. And so you get a lot of women and children who are left in villages. And then what happens is that, you know, men can be infected with HIV overseas and then come back and infect their wives. And it comes down to just a lack of understanding on both the part of the, you know, of the migrant themselves and their wives in relation to HIV. And the other thing is, because the southern part of Nepal anyway has got an open border with India, there's a lot of movement of people across the border, including amongst young people. So as I said, there's increasing risk amongst young people. A lot of our program is about raising awareness, you know, because there's such a lot of movement across the border between these two countries.
So what are the name of the towns or the cities that you're working in?
Okay. Down in the southern part of the country, we're working in two towns. One of them is called Dangari, which is in a district called Kailali, which is in the far west of Nepal. That's located about 5 to 10 kilometres from the border. I'm not exactly sure how far. And then the other one is in a town called Barawa, which is in the western part of Nepal, directly on the border. These are small towns. Each district has a regional town that could be anywhere between just 20,000 up to about 100,000. And the closer they are to the border, the more movement there is. And then in other parts of the district, we are working in a town called Pokhara. And those Australians who have travelled to Nepal to go trekking would know Pokhara because it's the departure point for a lot of the treks up to the mountains in that area.
In the capacity of your role, you probably travel to these towns?
I would be travelling about once every 3 or 4 weeks to one or another of our programs out in the west. My role is not so much to directly work with the communities, but more to work with our local program staff out in our program areas who are working directly with those communities. These are mostly local staff. In some instances, they can speak local languages. We're particularly in the southern part of the country, dominate over the national language of Nepali. And so I would just be providing support and advice to them about more the program management aspects of what they're doing, like the actual program design, monitoring and follow-up. Because a lot of the ideas about what we should actually be doing and who we should be including in our projects is actually inspired from them rather than from the national office level. And we're in Kathmandu here.
Because there's a sort of a relationship of trust?
Out in the west are actually local people, so they actually represent the communities where we are doing our projects. You know, we have some staff who are just located in the office in the towns, like, you know, more of our admin staff, but our project staff are actually very active. They're not in the office very much. They're out in the field projects. They are liaising with the local staff. They are building relationships. World Vision implements most of its programs through local NGO partners, and so building relationships with those partners and working with them to implement the projects is a very strong role of our project staff out in the western part of the country.
Louise, I wonder, is it hard at all for you to travel to these remote areas? I mean, Pokhara is not very remote, but some of the other towns you mentioned are probably not very easy to get to.
Yes, well, it is a challenge travelling out to the western part of the country. And I am meeting other project staff from other agencies working out in the west, and we do share stories. I guess the situation at the moment is, despite the fact there was a comprehensive peace accord signed in Nepal at the end of last year, there is still a lot of problems on the highway. I mean, different political groups are still pushing for recognition here in Nepal, and also ethnic groups too who have felt that they haven't been well represented in the country up until now either, particularly in the political sphere. And so they tend to try to get recognition by blocking the highway. So moving across the highways is not easy. The other thing is that we are 600 kilometres away from our furthest program. So most of the time we conduct all our travel on small planes.
Tell me about the political conflicts. Is it still with the Maoists?
Well, last year in November, the alliance of the existing 7 political parties signed this peace accord with the Maoists. And so soon afterwards, the Maoists ostensibly joined the new interim government. So now it's become 8 political parties. So the Maoists, who, you know, have been at war with the government led by the king up until April 2006, are now actually in parliament. So it's kind of a strange irony. But I guess there's still a lot of tensions there. Peace doesn't come to a country easily. It's actually a process that needs to be worked out. And I think what's happened here in Nepal is that now that the macro-level conflict that has existed between the King's Army and the government on the one hand and the Maoists on the other up until 2006 has given way, and now there's a number of other groups who still feel that they haven't been represented or haven't had a voice up until now. So they are also launching their own campaigns for recognition, and as part of that campaign means disruption of civil and public life.
So how do you mean? I mean, how do the political conflicts affect the quality of lives of those locals in the communities in which you work?
Whenever there's a conflict in a country, communities become very politicised. It's very difficult to stay neutral in a community in conflict, whether you're talking about a national level conflict or a local level conflict. People become aligned with organisations or political parties in order to get themselves heard. But then a lot of other people who are just trying to go along, trying to live their daily life, find it very difficult because, you know, whenever there are road blockages, supplies aren't getting through. Schools can be closed. People can be denied access to other parts of the district where their families might live. So it is very, very difficult. And I understand that there's still quite a lot of uncertainty and also fear out in the districts where World Vision and also a lot of other agencies are implementing their work.
What about in Kathmandu itself? Do you feel the conflicts or are they more notable in the more rural areas?
I think that it's more acute out in rural areas. Standard of living here in Kathmandu was a lot higher, and I think that out in rural and remote areas, which are already poor, I think conflict is felt by the people a lot more acutely. However, that's not to say that Kathmandu is not affected by it. Sometimes we feel here that we are functioning here in Kathmandu, but that things aren't really working. Like, for example, even today, the rubbish around the town hasn't been collected for weeks because the garbage collectors are on strike. We have
that could be difficult.
Well, it doesn't look good, particularly in the lead up to the start of the tourist season. It doesn't look particularly good. But there are just times when the roads around Kathmandu can be blocked by people demonstrating or people trying to raise awareness of some issue for the government, and so traffic doesn't move. A water shortage is here in Kathmandu for a lot of the times of the year, and also power shortages at times as well. But life goes on, and so we just sort of learn to live with them.
And what about your ability to interpret everything that's happening around you? How's the English there in Kathmandu? Do most people speak English?
Most people here in Kathmandu speak English very well. There are English daily newspapers that both Nepalese and also foreigners living here in Kathmandu are reading. There's some very active and interesting periodic magazines as well. I mean, there's a very strong academic culture here, and people, you know, despite a fear of being, you know, arrested, particularly journalists, there's still a very dynamic culture of media and of discussion, and so it can be very good to read. Out in the rural areas, though, there are no English-spoken newspapers. Media is very much focused towards local people, naturally enough, including a lot of FM radio stations, which are operating in local languages.
You've been living in Nepal for quite a number of years.
Yes, I've been working here for just over 2.5 years. I happen to be married to a Nepali, so I've like it or not, I have a long-term commitment here to Nepal.
And you intend to stay in Nepal?
No, I don't think either of us would want to be here longer term, because I know that my husband is quite keen to spend a while living in Australia, having visited a couple of times and just loved it. But also the two of us talk about living in a third country eventually as well. Both of us would like the experience of both being foreigners in a third country.
So apart from getting married after 2.5 years in Nepal, what would you say is your main achievement?
I think the one thing I've learned is that quite often the more you learn about a place, the more complex it gets. You think you understand a country when you know a few issues about it, but over time you realise that there's so much more to a country, particularly a country which isn't yours. But I think probably the most rewarding thing for me is being able to work with local Nepali staff, you know, to be supporting them to build up their own confidence and capacity to do their work. And they've just got so much guts and determination. And it's very challenging for them to maintain a positive outlook about their own country. But I'm constantly being humbled, I guess, by just talking to our local staff and their, you know, their longer term hopes for their country. And I think that's probably been the most rewarding aspect of my time here.
Louise, just before we finish up, can you tell us something in Nepali?
Well, I would say Dhanyabad, your radio station Ekdam Ramrota, and Tapai Ramro Sanga Zanus. And that means thank you. The radio station is really good.
Kookaburra.
Okay.